Accession number 10657, reel 36.
I think you were saying something about the artillery support from 98th Field.
Yes. it wasn't possible for them to give really close support because of the nearness of the enemy. But there was a very unfortunate incident during the early afternoon. They brought down a heavy concentration on battalion headquarters and B Company. Captain Kershaw, the adjutant, was killed, several other casualties, and in B Company, five were killed and several wounded. B Company was some little distance away from battalion headquarters, so that concentration didn't all come down in the same place, I don't think. This, of course, cut Dennis Neal and B Company down to only 20 men. And it was a heavy and unnecessary loss. But if we look back, we had guns falling short at Marath and guns falling short at Alamein as well. But it's a pretty awful thing to happen. Now, late in the afternoon, everybody was relieved to hear that the 6th and 9th Durhams were going to enlarge the bridgehead. 0 hour had been set at 1 a.m. But as dusk closed in, a Sherman tank approached the bridge down the Catania Road from the north. The commander of the tank was standing in the turret waving his arms. It was in fact a captured Sherman, not one of ours. It had come from some other part of the island, I imagine. And the man in the turret, of course, was a paratrooper. 200 yards short of the battalion positions, the tank stopped, opened fire with all its guns, and then withdrew. They really didn't miss any opportunity of inflicting casualties. There wasn't a moment went by when they weren't planning or doing something or other. Now, when the 6th and 9th Battalion attacked, the artillery barrage was a very heavy one again and must have caused casualties. And I think this particular barrage, although B Company were pretty close to the sunken road, I think maybe they might have got some shells, if not in the sunken road, a little bit behind where the paras had their headquarters. Both the 6th and 9th Battalions forded the river where A and D of the 8th had forded the previous night. But the Germans weren't caught napping. They laced the Catania Road and the Grapevines with Spandau fire. About 1:30 in the morning, the 8th Battalion men heard the 6th cross their front on the left of the Catania Road, whilst the 9th Battalion advanced on the right of the Catania Road. So that's the 6th going northwards from the bridge, the 6th Company going up, 6th Battalion going up on the left, and the 9th Battalion going up on the right. The paras stood their ground and fought it out. Even when the 6th and the 9th got beyond the sunken road, the Germans stayed put. By dawn on the Sunday morning, I think it was a Sunday then, the Germans were still in the sunken road, although they were cut off, and they were firing at any movement in the B Company positions behind the embankment. So they were very much there. Round about this time, some of the 8th Battalion, who were beginning to take a back seat, watched as some of the 6th and 9th supporting arms, including carriers and anti-tank guns, crossed the bridge and tried to get forward via the Catania Road to their forward units. They were told to go up the road, but they weren't told that there were still Germans not very far up the road. They were, in fact, still in position the Germans. And of course these supporting arms were ambushed. They recovered pretty quickly and were firing their anti-tank guns with solid shot at a range of about 5, 10, 15 yards or something like that. But they did lose the supporting arms. Some of the chaps managed to get back. The 6th and 9th Battalion weren't having things all their own way by any means. Now, remember now that there are two battalions across the scimitar, as well as what's left of the 8th still there. And Andrew Clark, who was the CO of the 9th Battalion, sent an urgent request for 3-inch mortars to lay smoke across the front of one of his companies, where they were pinned down on the right of the road by heavy spandau fire. Hampson was asked to do this, and it was the only occasion in the war when he ever used his mortars with smoke, but they succeeded in extricating the 9th Battalion Company. The Paris, however, had been shaken by the weight of the 2 Battalion attack, and when the Shermans crossed the bridge at 7 o'clock, they knew that the game was very nearly up. Now, at this point, the Brigadier met the Shermans north of the bridge and in no uncertain terms told them to deploy left and right of the road. He also pointed out where the enemy positions were, including the sunken road. The Shermans deployed left and right and, sure enough, broke through the vines. Perfectly okay. If they'd done it earlier on in the battle, the whole picture could have been very different. Anyway, they broke through, they shot at absolutely everything in sight, and the sunken road from the B Company positions, they could see and hear that everything had suddenly gone very quiet there, quieter than at any time during the last 24, 30 hours, whatever it was. White handkerchief fluttered, and an 8th DLI man stood up and walked towards B Company and the embankment, who were behind the embankment. He'd got several Germans with him. Some of the B Company men thought it was a trick, that a German had dressed himself in British uniform and was coming across with these other Germans, and they opened fire. And Neil had a lot of difficulty in actually stopping them firing. When he had managed to stop them firing, they came on. I think the DLI men leading them probably shouted that all was well or something like that. Anyway, when they came on, white handkerchiefs suddenly began to appear all along the line of the sunken road. There were about 80 paratroops surrendered to B Company alone. And on the other side of the road, similar situation. The bridgehead battle was over. Mopping up was completed by big mid-morning, and all resistance in the area of Primosoli Bridge was finished. Now, the rest of the day, the battalion spent burying the dead and evacuating the wounded.
Have you any idea why B Company should have thought it was a trick?
Well, because I think they were very trigger-happy by then. I think that they'd had 32 hours of this. I believe there was an instance, although I didn't see it, where some of our stretcher bearers were fired on at one stage. I think they were aware of the fact that the Germans had laced themselves up the trees. They knew they were up against an enemy who was very active indeed and knew all tricks of the trade. And I think that they thought, well, you've just got to, at this stage, we stayed alive this long, they might be up to something, so let's treat it as a trick and pop a few shots off in their direction. I think it was fairly understandable for men who'd been stuck in behind that embankment for all that time.
But you hadn't had that sort of thing before, had you?
No, we hadn't come across it before anywhere at all. I'm not at all certain that... I mean, it says that the 8th DLI bloke stood up. I mean, there is another possibility that B Company had had a pretty rough time and pretty heavy casualties, and here was an opportunity to knock off some more Germans. I haven't any proof for saying that. I don't even know whether it is true. But in the heat of battle, men do sometimes odd things. And Neil stopped it, of course, as soon as he saw what was happening. And I would imagine, too, as we said, that the chap probably shouted out, something like that. But it had been a... It really had been a terrific scrap. I mean, all our chaps who'd survived Alamein and Marith, which was really the fiercest fighting in the North African campaign, they said they'd never seen so much slaughter in such a small area during a period of not much more than 32 hours. It wasn't very long since the early hours of the morning when the 8th had crossed the river, and the mid-morning of the following day. That was the span of time. I mean, the three DLI battalions between them had lost 500 killed, wounded and missing. 300 German dead were found, and there were 160 German prisoners of war. I mean, the sunken road, which few people had seen until then, it turned out to be a long, very dusty, cactus-fringed lane. But it was a deep lane, as I said when I parked my car in it many years afterwards. And the whole thing was a shambles of smash rifles, automatic weapons, equipment, torn pieces of equipment, torn pieces of clothing, blood-stained, discarding clothing, piles of it where it had been removed from wounded, overturned boxes of ammo, and of course the anti-tank and an anti-tank gun at the junction of the Catania Road with the sunken road. But the worst thing really was that along the entire length of the sunken road, and in front of and behind it, they had the bodies of British and German dead which had not been buried. There hadn't been the opportunity or the time to bury anybody. And even today, if you talk to anybody who was at Primosole, who survived that battle, they won't tell you about the sunken road. They'll talk about Stench Alley, for a very good reason. The roadside ditches alongside the Catania Road were just as much a shambles, and it was really a scene of utter carnage in this very small area. And of course the smell was absolutely awful. There were also dead cows lying there, and farm animals and things which had been lying out, same sort of thing as in Normandy. But the London Times wrote on the 27th of August in 1943, they wrote about the German paratroops. They fought superbly, they were troops of the highest quality, experienced veterans of Crete and Russia, cool and skillful, Nazi zealots to a man, and fanatically courageous. To fight against them was an education for any soldier. Well, to capture and hold the bridge against that sort of opposition was a fine fighting achievement for the 8th Battalion, because it really was the 8th Battalion that bore the main brunt of what was going on. Anyway, I don't think there were any suggestions that it hadn't been a fair fight, although it was very, very fierce. And as the German battalion commander was being led away, this was Lieutenant Colonel Ludwig Heilmann, who was the CO of the 3rd Parachute Regiment. As he was being led away, the CO of the 9th Battalion, Andrew Clark, shook him by the hand. Sad to say, Andrew Clark was to die a few days later when German mortars hit a recce group, killing Andrew and fatally wounding his second in command. And that was that. Now, by midday, and I think we're still the same day, and I think it was the Sunday, the fighting for the bridge was over, but the Germans still tried to destroy it. They'd got the range of the bridge registered by one very heavy gun, which most people seem to think was on the lower slopes of Etna, or somewhere like that. from positions some miles to the north anyway. It was very accurate, and several 8th Battalion men were actually wounded bathing in the river. That night, 69 and 168 brigades extended the bridgehead, but the attack was only moderately successful. But it did, at last, bring 151 into reserve. And in the late afternoon of that day, the 8th were ordered to withdraw to a rest area on the high ground where the German Air Force rest camp had been. Now, A Company crossed the bridge quite safely, without any casualties, but they'd been seen by German OPs, and heavy long-range shelling started immediately from this heavy gun way back. B Company had left the shelter of the embankment. They were moving in extended order, but they were out in the open. One shell landed amongst a section, killed 5, wounded 4. B Company was now down to Dennis Neal and 10 men. As the wounded were being evacuated, Bob Lidwell was also wounded, although not seriously. The rest of the battalion forded the river, and everyone was well pleased to get away from Primosoli Bridge. One other tragic incident that night. When it got dark, Dennis Neal decided to go back with 4 volunteers to bury the 5 men who'd been killed by the long-range gun. And as he was making his way down to the river, he was stopped by Colour Sergeant Marsden of HQ Company. He was a territorial and one of the oldest members of the battalion. He said, "Is it okay if I join you, because I want to fill some water cans?" So Dennis said, "Yes, by all means." So they all went down to the river. And Marsden actually went down to the banks of the river to fill the water cans, whilst Dennis Neal buried our chaps some little distance away. But this blessed gun opened up again, and Marsden was killed by the first shell. So it just went on and on, you know. And Neal and his volunteers returned safely. I don't know whether it is still there, but there is a memorial at the junction of the Catania Road and the Sunken Road, which was built in 5 days with stones taken from the ruins of a German pillbox. And it was built by 2 sappers and 11 men from the 8th Battalion under the supervision of Captain John Wheatley of A Company. Many of the photographs in the battalion history are by John Wheatley. He was later killed in Normandy. So that's it.
And what's been happening to you then while all this
Well, I can fill in on that one if you like. Now, shall I do that bit? Have we got enough battery there? Well, I think we had got to the state where the German officer had turned me over and asked me how many divisions are there, and then I heard this shout, "Come on, B, are you afraid?" And I don't remember much more. I don't remember anything else until I came round, by which time I was in a shell crater, a fairly shallow one, and I don't know how I got there. And I was sort of, I was leaning just below the lip of the crater, and I remember feeling around or trying to get my hand behind my back, because I knew that's where the main damage was, but I couldn't get my right hand over because it was too painful, and the left hand I couldn't seem to get up there. So I think I must have passed out again, and the next thing I heard was 2 of our own chaps, who I assume were stretcher bearers, I heard one of them say, "Christ, he's finished. Leave him, he's had it." And they went. They disappeared. So...
You were in the vines, right? You were
In the shell. No, this was in the open. Amongst the vines, no. It wasn't very far from the road, but it was in the open, and I think it was a little bit closer to the sunken road than I realised, in actual fact. Now, 5:10, the 2 Shermans came up the road, which we talked about earlier on, which bucked me up a little, because I thought there might be an opportunity of getting back to my own lines. But the anti-tank gun fired, and off they went. Now, at 6 o'clock, I was joined by two Germans who jumped into the shell, the crater, and set up their Spandau gun about 12 feet away from me, something like that. They completely ignored me. I mean, I was obviously no danger to them. I must have looked a complete and utter wreck, half dead. No weapons of any sort anywhere near me because my pistol had disappeared and everything. And they just went on gaily firing away, and they glanced in my direction occasionally, and that was that. This was about 6 o'clock in the morning. And here I saw an opportunity. When the three Shermans came up the road, I thought to myself, well, if I can only get out of here, the battalion can't be far away. I knew that which direction to go in. And as the Shermans came along, the Spandau team picked up the Spandau and got out of the shell crater. They weren't going to mix it with the tanks. So I thought, well, I'm in the clear now. And I managed to sort of get on my knees and get out of this shell hole. And I'd only just about getting up on my feet and trying to lope sideways in that direction when, of course, the two Shermans went up, one after the other. And the next thing I knew was that the two Spandau guys were coming back into the shell crater with the Spandau. And they and I arrived back in the crater at about the same time. So that was that. Soon after that, when it became daylight and the sun came up, it was blistering hot, really very hot indeed. And I could see that there wasn't any way that I was going to get anywhere at all. So I thought, well, I'll use one of the few German words that I knew, which was Wasser. So I shouted out Wasser as loudly as I could. Some time afterwards, two Germans crawled into the shell crater. One was a young paratroop. The other was an elderly German, and I think he might have been from this 904 Fortress Battalion, which was with them in the bridgehead. And they decided that they would drag me back or get me back to their battalion headquarters. But it meant going over to the road and along the ditch, because that was the safest way to do it. They started dragging me towards the road, but I was a dead weight because I wasn't able to move myself very much. And an argument broke out between the para and the elderly German as to whether or not I was really worth all that trouble, and wouldn't it be easier just to shoot me and leave me there. I couldn't understand everything they were saying, but that's obviously what it was about. And the elderly German was very, very angry about the suggestion that was being made. If it had been two paratroops, I don't think I think they would have done it. But he stopped them. He was absolutely furious with this youngster and led off at him, and so they got me back to the ditch, dragged me along the ditch, and I eventually got back to the sunken road, out of the back of the sunken road, and I was loaded onto a stretcher and found myself on the ground pretty close to where the paratroop headquarters was, which was behind the sunken road and tucked away behind a little spur. Again, I don't even know whether anybody knew it was there. And while I'm lying there, a young German officer comes up and he said, "How are you feeling?" in perfect English. So I said, "All right." So he said, "I'm sorry, old boy, we're going to hand you over to the Italians." So I said, you speak very good English. And he said, "Well, I was at Oxford before the war." He said, "I must go now, though." He said, "Your mortars are proving troublesome again." And with that, this youngster darted off, you know, in the direction of the sunken road. And that was the last I saw of him. So from here, I was taken over to a German ambulance, which stopped on the road, loaded into the back of the ambulance, doors wide open. And whilst the doors were open, Hampson started one of his searches up the road on either side. And I and the Germans in the back of it, because there were several Germans in there, could see the mortar bombs were bursting nearer and nearer. And we all thought the same thing: if they don't shift this ambulance pretty soon, we're going to cop it. But they did move it, and the ambulance took us back to Catania Hospital, where I saw Jacko, who'd been evacuated there, the chap who'd been dragged along by the tank, Dick Holloway, my own platoon commander, and where we had a massive air raid on Catania that night that absolutely shook the foundations of the whole place. Now, the following day they took us to Cassina. We didn't go by ambulance, at least I went on my own. I was put on straw in the back of an open lorry to go to Messina. And here again you've got the two different type of Germans. There was a big wooden sort of thing behind the driver's cab, and the Germans stood up there and the wounded lay down on the straw. And I asked a German for some water, which he refused to give me. But another German, a younger one, he knelt down beside me and he gave me some water. No trouble at all. The other thing that I'll never forget was being spat at as we went through the villages by the women. We knew they weren't spitting at us. It could only be Germans they were spitting at, because we could have been German prisoners. But that's what the Sicilian women thought of them. We finally arrived at Messina, where I had an argument with a German surgeon who came out of the tent where they were operating in an apron that was absolutely covered in blood. And he said to me, very soon, he said, you will be finished at Primosole. I said, well, I don't know about that. We weren't doing too badly when I last, or words to that effect. And he said, right, he said, you stay outside all night. So a British paratroop sergeant who was there came over to the surgeon and said, look, you can't leave men lie out all night just because he said something you didn't like, or words to that effect. So I got taken inside, but that was my big mouth nearly getting me in trouble. At Messina, we were loaded onto an Italian hospital ship with German nurses, taken down to the operating theatre, where the Italian surgeon, before he carried out an investigative operation, I suppose it was, asked me why P.G. Wodehouse was allowed to write books in England, which was anti-British and anti-this and anti-that. And I had to explain to him the reason was that we were all for free speech, and if people wanted to say something in Britain, we didn't stop them saying it. But this was a crazy interlude, having this argument, lying on the operating table, waiting for him to put a bit of gauze over my face. Anyway, eventually I went into a ward, which was looked after by German nurses, and the other occupants of the ward were Germans who I think had been with the mountain batteries on Etna and hit by shell fire from our heavy ships, because they'd all got pretty horrific wounds, and all of them, without fail, were dropped over the side before we actually reached Livorno.
But they all died on the way, didn't they?
Died on the way. So I was the only one left in the whole ward. I was there, just me. When we got to Livorno...
How did the German nurses treat you?
Very well. Extremely well. This particular one was awfully nice. Very pretty, as I remember. And she was quite nice to me. Very nice to me indeed. Even though all these guys, they've taken them out. You know, one by one they went out. The ward got emptier and emptier. And the funny thing was that when we arrived at Livorno and we burst, I sat up in bed and a whole lot of Hitler Youth came rushing in to the ward, and they chucked stuff on the bed, soap, toothpaste, flannels, sweets, chocolate, all sorts of things, cakes. And the German nurse was there, and she helped me sort of sort the stuff out. About 2 or 3 minutes later, they came back, scooped it all up, and took it away. I said, what's all that about? Well, she said, they found out you were British, didn't they? So I was given all the stuff 1 minute, and the whole lot was taken away the next. And from Livorno, we went to Lucca Military Hospital, you know, the old walled city of Lucca, by ambulance, and this is where the Italians did a disgusting thing. We'd got several chaps in the back of the ambulance who were in a very bad way. Paratroop above me had had his foot blown off and was really very nearly dead, and they drove this ambulance flat out, swung it round the corners, all over the place. And of course, before we arrived at Lucca, the para died. And I was carried on a stretcher into the hospital. And as soon as I got there, the CO of the camp, it was a prison hospital, a British colonel came up and asked me a few questions. I said, look, don't bother asking me questions. They killed one of our chaps in that ambulance because of the way they drove it. He said, they do it every time. That was the Italians. And then, of course, I got asked a lot of questions about Sicily and the invasion and how it had gone and everything. And I was there, in fact, for 8 weeks. And after that period of time, the escape story starts.